Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. Our guest speaker will be Siobhan Fallon, author of You Know When the Men Are Gone. Ms. Fallon's stories and essays have appeared in Women's Day, Good Housekeeping, New Letters, and Publishers Weekly, and she's currently writing a fiction series for Military Spouse magazine. This program, part of the 6th Annual Diversity Matters Lecture Series at Metropolitan Community College, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, June 19, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Phyllis Brown, single-parent displaced homemaker coordinator with the TRIO program at Metropolitan Community College.
A little background about myself. I am a wife, a mother of soldiers, airmen. I myself retire on the 26th of this month from the Air National Guard, previous background in the Army and the Air Force as well. So again, this book is just very insightful. If you all get the chance to get it, I really encourage you to, because as, again, a spouse, the whole nine yard, this book just really tells the story. It'll give you a good idea as to what really every day is like in the life of a soldier's wife or spouse or those people who are left behind. Because really, without this work and that type of work that Ms. Siobhan does, it wouldn't happen. It could not happen. We are the ones who really sustain those soldiers while they are away. So without any further ado, I'll go ahead and read a little bit about Ms. Siobhan and bring her on up. Siobhan Fallon is an Army spouse whose debut collection of stories, You Know When the Men Are Gone, was listed as the best book of 2011 by the San Francisco Chronicle and Janet Maslin of the New York Times. Her stories and essays have appeared in Women's Day, Good Housekeeping, Newsletters, Publisher Weekly, among others, and she writes a fiction series for Military Spouse magazine. She earned her MFA at the New School in New York City and lives in Fall Church, Virginia, where her husband is still active duty. More can be found at her website, and again, we'll have that at the table for you. So without any further ado, please help me welcome Ms. Siobhan Fallon.
Thank you, Phyllis. Hi. There's a lot of chairs, if anybody wants to sit closer. I'm a little quiet, or just wave wildly if you can't hear me. It seems like the mic is okay. Okay. Thank you so much for having me here as part of this series. Thank you to Barbara Velasquez. She sent me one of the first emails I received when my book came out last year in hardcover, saying that she enjoyed reading it and inviting me here. And I was sort of in the middle of a crazy book tour and heading off to Amman, Jordan to join my husband who's stationed over there for the past year, and I couldn't come. And I thought, there's no way she's going to remember me next year and invite me again, but she did. And she's been just really supportive and wonderful of my story. So thank you. Thank you. As Phyllis said, I'm an Army spouse, and I've written a story collection set at Fort Hood, Texas. And some of the stories are from the point of view of the families who wait at home for their soldiers to return to them. And some of the stories are from the point of view of the soldiers themselves, who are either in Iraq or returning home and kind of entering that tricky transition period of trying to integrate themselves back into the life of the family who has been sort of getting along without them for an entire year. And I thought I'd give a little background of sort of Army wife life and writing life and sort of how it intersects and created this book. I'm not from a military family. My dad came over from Ireland as a teenager, and right after he got citizenship, he joined the Army, and he just sort of did his very short stint during the Vietnam era, but he sort of got his draft over with before it was really hot in Vietnam, and he ended up being a paratrooper in Germany. So he never saw combat, and he got out when his time was up. But he found a great little Irish pub in New York, and it was and he bought it, and he moved his family there. And it was right outside of the gates of West Point, or the United States Military Academy of West Point. So I was raised literally sort of outside of those big granite, beautiful walls on the Hudson. And I guess, kind of curious about the military lives that were going on sort of behind that fortified gate. And I was not curious enough to date Army guys, ever. If anything, my sister and I swore that we would not go out with cadets because they seemed sort of rigid and, I don't know, awkward in their horrible uniforms, and they could only walk up and down the main street of my town one Sunday a month, or I don't know. They had all these crazy rules. And I assumed that military folk were kind of regimented and boring. But I met my husband when I was getting my MFA in creative writing, and I was working at my dad's bar to pay the tuition for the new school. And he was very persistent, and so I broke my rule, and we started dating. And that was the beginning of my sort of education into what real Army folk are like. Flash forward a few years, we were stationed at Fort Hood, Texas in 2006. And this was the very beginning of the Petraeus Surge. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. The Army was really upping the amount of soldiers or boots on the ground in Iraq at that time. And it sort of lasted a couple of years, and it was a very intense deployment cycle at the larger bases where a lot of these soldiers were coming from, especially a place like Fort Hood, which is the largest military installation in the free world, or at least American military base. So we were stationed there. My husband, he's done a total of 3 deployments, 1 to Afghanistan, 2 to Iraq. And when we were at Fort Hood, he became a company commander of a 160-man infantryman unit. And just to clarify, in the United States Army, infantrymen are still men. So soldiers in my husband's world were males, and the spouses were females. So that sort of comes up in my book, and people are always asking me, and of course I know there are incredible female soldiers. There's Phyllis. I mean, there's tons of really fine female officers and soldiers and across the board. But to simplify things, I sort of kept it delineated like that in my book just to make it easy. And again, it's fiction. But So he was in charge of a 160-man unit, and I, by default, became the family readiness group leader, which is the tradition that the company commander's wife sort of leads this volunteer group. And my role was to be sort of the official voice of, like, or passing on information from official Army or like my husband's unit to the spouses, the moms, the dads, the godparents. Anybody who wanted to know about that soldier would call or email me. So even though I had been an Army spouse for 4 years at that point and been through 2 other deployments at that time, I felt like because I was interacting so much and on a daily basis with so many different families, I had a whole new insight into kind of the spectrum of the Army family experience. And in this very specific time when soldiers were deploying for 12 to 16 months, coming home, and they were lucky if they're home for a year before they were deploying again. So it was a very heightened atmosphere where you were always aware of the war, and you were always aware of the danger that your spouse was in. So kind of had a heightened feeling of, I don't know, you still are having to do all the normal things that every mom and dad has to do, get the kids to soccer practice or grocery shop, make spaghetti. But at the same time, part of you is always thinking, am I going to get a call from my husband tonight? Will I get an email and know he's okay? So just kind of that extra bit of anxiety was, I feel like, very prominent in our lives. But at the same time, like the FRG, what I was doing, we were trying to create a support system, and I think the Army does try to do this, of very quickly trying to make a community so that you have people you can rely on. And we would have meetings. I would have military life consultants, which were an anonymous group of psychiatrists at Fort Hood, and it's something the Army has really bolstered over the past few years. And they would talk to the spouses and the children. if anybody had any issues and wanted to talk or felt the need to talk to anyone, no one needed to know. You could meet at a coffee shop off post. You could talk on the phone. So I was seeing the Army was trying to address sort of the needs of its family. And also as an FRG leader, I was very aware of the people who were sort of falling through the cracks. And that became sort of the subject of the stories I was writing at the time. And the stories in this book just, I felt like I was not helping all the people I ought to have helped. And I think I wrote some of these stories sort of figuring out like why they were making bad decisions. And I don't know. You'll see when you, if you read the book, the stories. I've been asked why some of my story is a little dark, and I think that motivation for me to sort of show the good and the bad of what was happening in Army Post, because I wanted to honor the difficulties that soldiers were going through and the difficulties the families were facing at home without their soldiers. I am sorry, I am just talking on and on and on. So my husband was deployed. I was writing the stories. Fort Hood had this great policy that they gave the families of deployed soldiers 16 free hours of daycare a month. And I would sit in the Burger King across the street from the daycare. I'd leave my daughter in the daycare and run over there and try and write these stories, drinking a massive cup of coffee. And I'd use every minute of the 16 hours. And sort of sitting at that fast food restaurant, I would see so many different soldiers and families come in, and kind of inspired me as well and helped me kind of clarify details of Fort Hood life. So I think I'll read an excerpt, and then if you guys have questions afterwards, please think of some questions. There's not too many of you, so I hope everyone has at least one at the end. As I said, there are 8 different short stories. Most of them are about 30 pages, so I'm going to read the shortest one, which is nice and short. But read the stories, please, because they're all very different, and this one is a little sadder than most. Gold Star. Josie Schaefer drove around the commissary parking lot looking for a space. She had forgotten it was payday. She never shopped on payday, when the biweekly paycheck was automatically deposited into every soldier's account in the United States Army at the same instant, and therefore into the checkbooks of the 40,000 soldier families here at Fort Hood. The parking lot was a tangle of women pushing overflowing shopping carts, kids hanging on to the back or skidding around in wheeled sneakers, pickup trucks with their beds full of toilet paper and diapers. Checking her watch again, she finally pulled into the empty Gold Star family designated spot in front. She waited a moment, peering at herself in the mirror, composing her face into what she imagined an ordinary face looked like, tugging her mouth into a smile, but then giving up. She knew the spouses walking by with their loaded carts were hesitating, trying not to stare into Josie's window, trading lifted eyebrows with the other women passing. This was why she avoided the Gold Star spot. Gold Star, with its imagery of school children receiving A's and stickers for a job well done, was the military euphemism for losing a soldier in combat. Family members received a few special privileges, like a parking spot, but that meant that the pity rising from the asphalt singed hotter than any Texas sun. Inside, the commissary was even more packed than the parking lot. Shoppers inched their carts forward, each aisle a halting 4-car pileup. Josie moved through the crush, keeping her oversized sunglasses on, hoping no one would recognize her. She glanced at the shelves and tried to remember how to feed a man. It was easier than she thought it would be. The items that her husband once craved stood out, and she carefully filled her basket. A loaf of crusty French bread, a package of Swiss cheese, 1/2 pound of roast beef, a bag of tortilla chips, a jar of hot Tex-Mex salsa. A soldier had called her an hour ago, leaving a nervous, rambling message on her machine. "This is Specialist Murphy, ma'am. You don't know me, but I was hoping I could come and see you sometime, if it's convenient. It's, I knew your husband." At that point, Josie lifted her head from the couch. "Sergeant Schaefer, your husband? Well, I was with him the day the IED went off." The voice continued as she reached for the phone. "Come over for lunch. Can you do that?" she asked abruptly. "Ma'am? You mean today?" Josie nodded into the phone as if he could see her. "Today, as soon as you can." "Yes, ma'am. I'll be finished with my physical training at 1300 hours. Is that all right?" Josie looked around at her cluttered kitchen with its unwashed dishes. The laundry she had washed the week before and piled up on her couch, still not folded. She had 2 hours before 1 o'clock and no food in the house. "That's fine," she said. Later, back at the commissary with her groceries, Josie heaved all the rumpled clothes onto her bed and did the same with the piled books and newspapers. She hesitated in front of the mirror over her bureau. Grief had disfigured her. There were bags under her eyes that never faded, even when the crying finally did. Her shoulders were curled into themselves as if she were trying to keep something fragile and cracked safe inside her ribs. And the weight she'd lost in the past 3 months had exacerbated the creases in her forehead and around her mouth. So aged at 26. She brushed her bangs down over her eyebrows, pulled her dark hair into a ponytail, and checked her T-shirt for stains. In the first weeks after Eddie's death, there had been visitors, soldiers who came to her apartment and sat uncomfortably on the edge of her chairs. She almost hated those smooth-faced boys, each one of them alive, able to run their 5-mile physical training at dawn, go to a Burger King drive-thru, catch a movie, get picked up for a DUI, able to do anything. They seemed to sense her blame, never accepting her offers of coffee or potato chips, afraid to look her in the eye, rarely speaking to her other than the Army requisite, ma'am. But they stayed in her home for hours, waiting to be relieved by another soldier, as if acting on direct orders from their chain of command to keep guard. She knew they were there to ensure that she didn't starve to death or slit her wrists in the shower. They also ensured that she didn't stay in her bedroom with the covers over her head. She had to exist because the soldiers sat on her couch and watched Fox News. They had known her husband, how disciplined and focused he was, and so she changed her clothes each day, vacuumed the rugs, wiped cola spills off the countertops. There were also wives who timidly knocked on her door, first the care team led by the chaplain's wife, then wives from the family readiness group whom she recognized from past military balls and barbecues. But Josie had always kept herself apart, sure that she and Eddie would be out of the Army soon and any military friendship would be a waste of time. The wives, too stunned to smile or speak, had stared at Josie, seeing their own worst nightmare. They made up for their silence with food, tons of it, exquisite meals or simple casseroles that Josie couldn't stomach, and they left bereavement cards on her table that Josie wouldn't read. She wanted to tell the women to go home and be kind to their husbands instead of wasting their time with her. "Take care of your man," she would have liked to say, whispering, "take care before it's too late." But the soldier coming over today was someone she wanted to meet. She wanted him to talk about her husband, to tell her a story, so she could picture Eddie again, his wide mouth, his square fingers tapping his knee, his blonde hair catching the sun as he tipped his head back in laughter. Already the Eddie in her mind was looking too much like the photos in the apartment, frozen and posed and still. It was the moments in between that she was the most afraid of forgetting. The moments that were too ordinary for photographs, the small memories like waking up with him in the morning, how he held his knife and fork when he ate dinner, the concentration in his blue eyes when he did a crossword puzzle, his feet propped up on the coffee table, or the way he walked in after a week-long training exercise and sat down on the couch to take off his boots. She would climb up on his lap, put her arms around his neck, and press her face into his chest, and stay there as he rubbed his stubbled chin over the back of her head. She could smell all the days he had been away in his uniform, the dirt from the field and the burned smokiness of his sweat and the thin smell of gasoline from his Humvee and the oil he used to clean his rifle. He would put his big hands around her back, and she felt enclosed in his strength and knew he was hers again, at least for a little while. but now she had forgotten the texture of his uniform under her cheek, the sound of his boots slipping off his feet and hitting the floor, the feel of his fingertips on her back. She was losing him all over again. "Hello, ma'am," said the soldier. He held a bouquet of carnations, and his face didn't know whether to look grin or look somber. "I'm Specialist Murphy. Kit Murphy, ma'am." "Kit, please call me Josie," she said, opening the door farther, taking in the sight of him. He was young, 20 or 21, tall and bony, his uniform loose around his shoulders and waist, as if he had not always been so thin. His skin was the grayish-white of a wet piece of paper, and there were dark smudges under his eyes. It wasn't until he stepped across the threshold that she noticed his limp and peered at his left foot and the black ski boot contraption. Then she realized who he was. 2 months after Eddie's funeral, the Army held a memorial service, awarding him the Bronze Star with a V for valor, suddenly claiming Eddie had saved someone's life. Josie didn't go. Eddie's father had flown down from Michigan to accept the decoration, taking it home with him. This was also around the time that the soldiers stopped standing guard over Josie and the wives no longer brought food, as if the community had ascertained she was no longer a risk to herself. Without their vigilance, Josie started just stretching out on her couch all day. "Are those for me?" she asked Kit. He looked down at the flowers in the right hand as if they didn't belong to him, and his pale cheeks turned red, making him look almost healthy. "Yes, ma'am," he said. "I thought I should bring something." "They're nice." Josie took the dangling bouquet from his hand. The smell of flowers made her think of wet dirt and the Kleenex that disintegrated into pulp as she rubbed it against her eyes during the funeral. She had tried to be dignified, but was barely able to breathe during taps. Josie found a dusty vase in the kitchen and called to the soldier who still stood in her living room. "I hope you like roast beef." Kit nodded and walked toward her, pausing in front of all the frames. She had gone through her albums and removed her favorites, putting Eddie wherever she could, nailing him into the four walls, so that wherever she turned, he would be looking at her. "Sergeant Schaefer was the best non-commissioned officer I ever met," Kit said softly, picking up a photo of Eddie from his Ranger School graduation. Josie put a plate of sandwiches and a jug of instant iced tea on the table. Her hands were shaking, and the tea sloshed against the rim. "He loved his job, ma'am," Kit continued. "He made other people love their jobs, including me." He put the photo down and eased into a chair, sitting in front of the sandwiches and taking one before Josie had time to get out the napkins and plates. He would say things like, "There is an entire video game industry trying to copy what you men get paid to do every day." Or, "You defend your country, you carry a gun, you blow things up. What do you have to complain about, soldier?" Kit laughed with his mouth full, his eyes on the photos ahead of him. Josie poured sweet tea into a tall glass and slid it across the table. This wasn't what she wanted to hear. Eddie had been planning on submitting his exit paperwork when he got home from Baghdad. He could have gotten out of the Army the previous year. His commitment was up 5 months before that deployment to Iraq, and Josie had been jubilant. But then he told her he couldn't leave his platoon right before they went to war. It was as if they had been training for the state championships, and now that the practice was over and the big game was here, he was abandoning them. "It's not a game," Josie said. But Eddie didn't listen. It had been a fight that raged for days. She threatened to leave him, asked him who he was really married to, damn it, her or his men. That was why they had no kids. She wasn't going to have a child who saw his daddy only every other year. For the 5 years they'd been together, she had used that argument against him, knowing eventually Eddie would want a kid more than he'd want the Army, and he'd get out, and she would win. And then Eddie was dead a month before coming home to her, and there would never be a child now. That was what her bargaining got her. "I want to hear about the IED," Josie said, sitting down across from Kit, balling up a napkin in her hands. "Nobody would tell me the details." Kit swallowed his mouthful and took a huge gulp of his tea. Josie wondered when he'd eaten last. "He saved my life," Kit said softly, looking into his glass. There were crumbs on his chin. "Did he mean to save your life?" Josie could feel her voice rise with the edge it had taken on lately when she spoke on the phone with Eddie's father, who seemed proud of his son for dying, for getting blown up thousands of miles from home on a roadside in the middle of nowhere, his blood soaking into another country's sand. "Did he know he was saving you?" Kit moved uncomfortably in his chair and didn't look at her. We were trapped in our Humvee, and his body protected me from the flame, ma'am. It was almost like he was hugging me to keep me out of the fire. Almost like. Kit put down his tea carefully. He kept his eyes on the table and blinked, sucking in his cheeks so that he looked even more starved and sickly. He lifted his face and looked, and his wet eyes finally looked into Josie's. I don't mean any disrespect, ma'am, but does it matter? I'm alive because of your husband. He was the best soldier I knew, and he saved my life. She hesitated. There were so many arguments in her head, angry words to toss at this man in front of her, denials and recriminations. The first reports Josie had heard said her husband died instantly in the blast. No heroism, just death. But if Eddie had deliberately saved this boy's life, then he had deliberately sacrificed his own. He had been conscious and in agony, and he had known he was leaving her behind. They sat for a while, Josie holding her napkin, Kit with his hands on the table next to his half-eaten sandwich. He cleared his throat. I would have been at the memorial service, but I was still in the hospital in Germany. I'm real sorry I missed that, ma'am. Josie shrugged. I wasn't there either. The funeral was bad enough. Kit nodded once as if he understood pain was something you lived with as best you could. Thank you for lunch. He took a piece of paper out of the pocket of his sleeve and handed it across the table to Josie. Here's my cell phone number. Please call me if there's anything I can do. I'm pretty busted up, but I can take out the garbage and open jars of pasta sauce or whatever it is they say men do better than women. He forced a smile that didn't touch his eyes. Wait, Josie said, standing. Don't leave yet. She glanced around the kitchen. I'll wrap those sandwiches so you can take them with you. I'll never eat all this food. But instead of getting out the tinfoil, she stepped around the table and stood in front of him, her thigh almost touching his bent knees. Kit looked up at her alarmed, as if she might hit him or kick his wounded foot. Before he could get out of his chair, she sat down on his lap. Ma'am, I have to be back at headquarters. Shh, Josie whispered, linking her fingers around his neck. She pressed her face into the stiff folds of his uniform and felt the Velcro of his rank against her cheek. She tried to smell her husband, but this uniform was too new, too clean, this soldier too thin and fragile, so rigid in the chair, sucking in his breath. But Josie held on, the camouflage material swimming in front of her eyes, the back of his neck smooth. After a dazed moment, Specialist Kit Murphy put his arms loosely around her, and Josie Schaefer clung to him, knowing this man was not her husband, that her husband was never coming back. But for now, she was as close to him as she could get, and she would not let him go. Thanks. All right, now is when I make you all ask me questions. So I think we have some time.
How did you get these women to open up to you? I mean, it sounds so in-depth and so personal that it seemed almost impossible to talk about.
I think my bartending skills have made me a good listener. And I feel like that also helped train me as a writer in a way to sort of observe and take note of details that I might have missed otherwise. But I've always found that the spouses are more ready to talk about their experiences than the soldiers themselves. And you get a bunch of them together, and they're very willing to share their stories. And I think soldiers are too, but it might be sort of when they're with other soldiers. And we had a lot of barbecues, a lot of military balls, and I love to hear a good story. So I would listen a lot, and you might even say eavesdrop, and just sort of listen to how things really were. But nobody has ever recognized any of my characters or even thought any of the events were from actual events from my time at Fort Hood. So I did try very hard to create fully fictionalized, you know, accounts of themes that I would see sort of rise up again and again. But
hey, would you say that overall the spouses that you deal with that lost family members there, that they want to hear from soldiers that were, you know, with them? Do they want to hear those? I mean, does that come up a lot, that they want to hear from those guys?
I don't know. I think it's probably on an individual case, but the few widows that I have talked to seem to very much want to talk about their husband's story and the, you know, how he died in combat or whatever. So I would think that they would want to talk to the soldiers that were with him. I mean, I think it probably depends on maybe how fresh the wound is, but I get emails from widows, and they tell me their husband's story and seem to want to have a conversation about it. So I would think that they do.
Yeah, you said your husband's in the Army, right?
Yes.
Yeah, just what's your opinion of the Army?
I actually love the Army, and he's a career officer. He's not getting out anytime soon. He's got 12 years in. And it's treated us very well. I love the life, and I love what the Army offers, the schools, the healthcare, you know, and I think this war has been going on for a very long time, but the Army is trying its best to sort of mitigate its effects as much as possible, but it's a huge bureaucracy, and it's sort of taking them a while to catch up, but I think they're trying very hard, and especially my husband's last deployment, they were very involved and really wanting the spouses to feel as rooted as they could and felt like they had places to turn when they needed something. So they're trying, and I like it. Why, are you thinking of joining? Oh, you were.
With most of the soldiers back or coming back, what do you think the greatest need is for the soldiers who have served in either Afghanistan or Iraq?
What is their greatest need in terms of, like,
readjusting to the U.S. or just, yeah, physical, emotional, family?
Wow, I don't think anyone has asked me that before. I think something that was really helpful for me as a spouse was knowing that that transition period is going to be kind of rough. I feel like we being military community and, you know, the civilian community, you sort of just have this image of these flags waving and the wives running and jumping into their soldiers' arms, and you assume it's perfect and it's going to be perfect, and that's, you know, this nice photo opportunity, but it's tricky for both sides. I mean, the soldier who's lived a completely different life for, I don't know, 9 months now, or the deployments to Afghanistan, and suddenly being back in America where there are rules to the road and you can depend on electricity and you shouldn't curse in front of your children. I mean, just all of these things that I don't think we really think about until we're thrust into that situation. And for the spouse who's been handling everything for an entire year, and suddenly the soldier comes home and is like, I don't like how you balance the checkbook. What have you been doing? What did you spend money on? So just these sort of sharp edges that have kind of grown and then suddenly need to be rounded down and fit back together again. So I liked, and I feel like military spouses kind of don't talk about it amongst themselves even, that it's going to be hard. And it's nice to hear it from other people that they're having a little bit of a rough time too. So when I get emails from military spouses, sometimes they say, like, wow, thank you. I thought I was the only one who was having a tough time. So I think knowing you should be patient and things are not going to be perfect immediately is sort of a good way to go into it. But in terms of bigger issues, I don't know. Is that what you're asking? More like, okay.
Your experience is Army and mine is Air Force, mm-hmm. but I think the commonality among the wives is, like in the Air Force, they have key spouses where they meet on a regular basis as a support system, and they talk about the stuff that you're talking about. And for the active duty people, I know the suicide rates is high. And that's why General Casey, the chief of staff for the Army, I think worked with University of Pennsylvania to come up with a workshop that they can teach everybody, all DOD. And in the Air Force now, our first-term airmen have what we have, the resiliency training. We learned that from you guys. And it is stressful reintegrating after two, three, four deployments, not only for the spouses but for the active duty themselves.
Yeah, and the Army soldiers, at least, I know my husband came back in 2009 from his most recent combat deployment. He had to take a week of classes at the base, and I think he got home on a Sunday, and he had to report to work at 8 o'clock the following Monday, and all the spouses were so furious, like, are you kidding me? Are you making him go to work? But it was to take these classes and to talk to psychologists, and they do sexual harassment, they do like drunk driving, they just try and check those blocks so that these guys are aware that you are back and things are different here. And the spouses as well, we would have deployment briefs or redeployment briefs, they'd call them, and they had a chaplain, they had a psychologist, they had the rear detachment commander, they had finance there, and they would talk to us and sort of what I was saying earlier about give us a sense of how things have changed and make us aware. And that's huge. I mean, we certainly didn't get anything like that in 2004. 2004, they just gave us our soldier, and we were excited, and we went to, I don't know, Disneyland or something, you know. So the Army's realizing and trying to fix what they can. So I'm glad the Air Force does, too. It's great.
Thanks for the story. I served 26 years, been like your husband, many deployments, but one thing I want to point out is probably the children. We talk about spouses, but it's hard for me to talk about. Children have a big impact. Do you talk about that at all in your book, the children?
I do. I have a story about a teenage girl who runs away from home and takes her 5-year-old brother with her, and sort of a reaction to the upheaval on base. And absolutely. My daughter was 6 months old when my husband deployed his last time, and we were trying so hard to get her to crawl, like just so he could see some milestone. And of course, 2 weeks after he left, she started crawling. But I mean, he missed her first words, he missed her first steps, like all these things. But at the same time, for me, I thought it was the best age for him to miss because she didn't miss him. You know, she wasn't aware, or at least she couldn't put into words how she was feeling and dealing with it. So I can't even imagine parents who have anyone older than that age when they're saying, where's my mom or where's my dad? And not understanding that entire chunk of time spent apart. And the parent who's missing ballerina recitals or basketball games. I mean, it's tremendous. And I don't know what people do.
I think you brought it up in your book a little bit, just kind of answer your question. My mom was showing me something where you said the soldiers oftentimes on the base, I mean, you meet women in the area, and you wind up getting married quickly because you're always in the field or you got to deploy right quick and, you know, you want to keep her around or whatever. But what happens is you come back, and, it happens a lot. These guys come back, and that's not always, love.
Right.
And these guys come back, and they're not really the same. So just answering your question is just space. Like, when you come back, your soldier, your Marine, or your airman, or your sailor, sometimes they just want space, you know. But when you give them that space, though, that's part of the love, or that's part of knowing them. You know, you're giving them a little bit of distance. Because when you come home, the first thing everybody wants to do is they want to jump in your arms. They want to go to Disneyland. They want to go to the mall. They want to go to everywhere and do all these things. And you know, that's not always the best thing to do a lot of times for some guys. So just space. And I think, like you said, that the government's done a
phenomenal job, I think, of, you know, anything you need. I mean, they've done a great job of providing it, but nothing beats the family. So you love your soldier or your Marine or whatever, give them that space. It's okay to give them a little space.
That's a great point, 'cause, or to depress whatever sort of things they're thinking about, yeah. It's really good. And there's one of the stories in here actually has part of a manual of what they gave out to spouses, and part of that is, like, don't expect to regain the intimacy of your marriage, like, immediately. Like, it's going to take a few days, and I feel like it says up to 6 months before you're going to be back to where you were before your deployment. And at 6 months, if you haven't gotten there, then seek marriage counseling. And they have marriage counseling, you know, on the base. So space and trying to work things out is huge. Yeah.
I wonder how many people have read the book. You're missing some great stories. You really need to read it.
Thank you.
I want Phyllis to say, tell us how it was when she read it, because she just was describing to me.
As I was saying, actually I was just excited about it, because being a spouse, it just gave me such insight that I really read this book in one setting, and that was incredible to me. I read a lot anyway, but I don't read a book in one setting. I just could not get enough of this book. So when Siobhan came in, and also Barb, I was showing them that I dog-eared the pages, because I could just relate to the stories. Either I was that person or knew someone. Of course, we're never that person, but I'll tell the truth. So I was a couple of those characters. So if I'd have had this book about 10 years ago, it probably would have saved me a lot of time in therapy. But grace and mercy, and this is my son, so I'm not his spouse when he was like, give him space. I was that person just all in his space, and I didn't understand it. So great question. And again, I just don't want to just monopolize the time, but this is just a book that I'm telling you, if you're just concerned at all, or you just want to know what it's like to actually live that life, you just see the parades, but, you know, when the balloons are all popped, you know, that's when it all really happens. So again, grace and mercy, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Phyllis. I want you to sign my book. You're awesome.
I haven't read the book, but I plan to purchase it tonight. My husband was in the military for 20 years, so traveling in other countries and all the different experiences, and like you, I think it was very good to us. We were in it at times when there were conflicts, but he wasn't right in the thick of things all the time. So I'm grateful for that. But my question has to do with, how do the military families now that are serving in war zones keep things together? Because it's a volunteer force, mm-hmm. very different from the way it was a long time ago. And so unless you have a relative or a close friend or someone serving in that capacity, I see people who are totally removed. They will, like, watch parades and do things and say, we support the troops, and just kind of give lip service. But there's so much more that can be done. And I'm glad the military is taking the initiative to do that. But I'm really concerned with the very young soldiers who are going out there, and how is this going to impact them the rest of their lives? How are they going to be impacted in terms of their work in civilian life? You know, and I hope that the companies are beginning to take up that idea of providing special services and support, so that these young men and women coming back will have a place in the workplace, because they've given up so much of their lives. I mean, some even their lives. Mm-hmm. But those that have been wounded, those who are emotionally traumatized by what they've experienced, I think as a civilian population, we need to do everything that we can to be supportive and be mindful that we have a role to play.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point, employment. And I think that's probably one of the best things civilian companies can do, is try to hire returning vets. I've done a couple events at Walter Reed, and in the unit where the wounded warriors are, And it's really shocking to see these 20-year-old boys who have no legs, and they're incredible. I mean, they're smiling, they're telling me their stories, they wheel themselves around, they have muscles so big. I mean, just, they're these really bright, enthusiastic young men, and I think that would be really incredible if, as a demonstration of our gratitude as a country, we made a point of hiring them as often as we can. So, yeah, so write our congressman and tell our friends who have small businesses.
In the Air Force, mm-hmm. we're gaining more positions for counselors, mm-hmm. whether it's in the Airmen and Family Readiness Center or in the Education Center, because part of this executive order is they want the vets to really get the counseling that they need on how to be gainfully employed. And so I think that's one that they're doing now. I'm not sure about the other services,
right.
but the Air Force is doing that now.
Excellent. Good. Well, then I hope Army and everyone else can learn from them, however they're doing it. It's great. And, I mean, and you have great programs like Wounded Warrior Family Support that supports both the family and the soldier, airman, marine, and just does incredible things. They send them to a condo near Disney for a week and just let them sort of try and work out these issues that we're talking about and just have a stress-free time to reintegrate and just be a family and not have to worry about their rehabilitation and everything else that's been plaguing them, money issues and everything else. So Wounded Warrior Family Support, for those of you who are looking for a charity that really actively changes lives, that's a good one. It's right here in Omaha. So, please.
I would like to say that I'd like to compliment you, Chauvin, on putting together a book that, when you look at the cover, it may interest you, but I know for myself, I had no idea what I was opening. I had no idea the diversity that's in that book. And for educators, I really believe that you can take those stories and address many academic concepts. One of the stories that I would say would be very valuable in a multicultural issues type class would be the soldier who had married a woman from another country and how her life was in relation to the other wives who were behind. And there's so much you could tell that those other wives didn't understand about her that comes out of this story. So, I mean, the richness of your research and your writing, I mean, God bless the Burger King. Because they must have been serving some great coffee there where you were writing, because it is an amazing they're amazing stories. I had my mouth open often during the reading. I don't think I read it in one setting, but I had trouble setting it down too. So,
how do you deal with telling these stories over and over again? I mean, you've been doing this for a while now, obviously. I mean, it's got to be heart-wrenching for you to re-go through these over and over and over again. I mean, do you have a bartender that you talk to?
I'm just so excited that people are talking about military issues. I think it's fantastic that schools or bookstores or book clubs, that they are engaging in this discussion, talking about our vets and, you know, the issues that military families are facing. So I am just thrilled that anyone wants to read about life at Fort Hood. I think it's great, and I just appreciate the dialogue being had. And, you know, whatever, when you go home and tell your friends, more like the vet issues is what I'm hoping gets out. So thank you for just having me talk, for even thinking that, you know, people would be interested in discussing this sort of thing. So, and then I have my poor husband who has to listen to me when I am complaining or having trouble with a story or anything else. So he's sort of my therapist. But mostly it's great. I mean, this is what every writer wants is to have people read their book, to have it published and on a shelf. So I'm just very lucky all around. I am working on a novel right now, and a lot of it takes place in the Middle East where we're living. And one of the couples, there are two main couples, one of the couples military and the other civilian, and it's more like the embassy world more than a military base, but there's some sort of military things going on. So please cross your fingers for me. I'm not done, so let's hope I pull it off.
I want to thank everybody very much for taking the time this evening. It's College World Series, and there's all sorts of competition out there, but we knew that this would be a great place to be tonight. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to a program from Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. Our guest speaker was Siobhan Fallon, author of You Know When the Men Are Gone. Ms. Fallon's stories and essays have appeared in Women's Day, Good Housekeeping, New Letters, and Publishers Weekly, and she is currently writing a fiction series for Military Spouse magazine. This program, part of the 6th Annual Diversity Matters Lecture Series at Metropolitan Community College, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, June 19, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Susan Hart, Public Relations Specialist, and Barbara Velasquez, Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.